All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the monthly meeting, the Zoom meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, also known as ACSOL, ACSOL, or the Alliance. So, my name is Janice Bellucci. I happen to be the founder of the organization, and I'm a board member, and I'm also currently its executive director. That's a lot of titles. And I don't mean to overwhelm you by that, but just to explain a little bit about who I am. Hoping all of that you figured out, I'm also a lawyer. I'm a lawyer who's only licensed in California. However, I do file lawsuits outside the state of California with the help of local counsel. So recently, I have filed lawsuits in Missouri and Arkansas, and that's because I found an attorney in those states who was willing to serve as local counsel. So, again, the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws is our monthly meeting. We did not have a meeting in October because we had a conference in October, and the conference was virtual. And as much as I would like to clone myself and be able to clone myself, I haven't figured that out yet. So, I could only be in one place. Was indeed at the conference last month. So happy to see you all. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We have meetings every month. Usually, I mean, always and always on Saturdays. We do record these meetings as well. And in fact, this meeting is being recorded now. I know we had some other conversations before the meeting was recorded, but now everybody, please know that it's meetings being recorded, and therefore be careful about what you say because we are recording it, and in fact, we will be making it available to the public. Always know who comes to our website, and from time to time, we've had I'll just call them troublemakers, some people might call them trolls, come to the website and try to conduct mischief, shall we say. After all, it's October, right? It's Halloween time, trick or treat. So as much as we all like treats, sometimes there are tricks as well. I'm planning to talk about a variety of topics today, but there's one topic that I'm planning to talk about because of the time of year, and that topic is Halloween. So I certainly can talk about Halloween from the perspective of lawsuits that I have filed, but I'd also like to know from your jurisdiction if you have anything that you consider to be, I know, just I'll make the question more open than that. If in fact you have Halloween restrictions in your state or your city, what are they like? How are they affecting you? Those kinds of things. Before I delve into Halloween, one of the things that I talk about all the time, every single month, is in fact something that could affect everybody who's listening to this, whether it's today in real time or to the recording, and that in fact is something called compliance checks. So I just want everybody to understand the law when it comes to compliance checks. There is the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that says we should all be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. Okay. So when the law enforcement comes and knocks on your door and they say, oh, this is a compliance check, right? Your response to that can be different depending upon, and should be different depending upon whether or not you're on parole, probation, or neither one of them. Okay. If you're on parole or probation, you likely have a condition that basically says that law enforcement can come in and search your home and your possessions at any time, also your car, by the way. Okay. So again, if you're on probation or you're on parole, some people just say on paper, then in fact you have fewer constitutional rights or lesser constitutional rights. Including, again, the fact is that many people on parole or probation have a condition that says that basically your home, your car, your computer, any of your possessions can be searched at any time. Okay, so how do compliance checks fit in here? And why am I even bringing up the Fourth Amendment? Because again, if you're not on parole and you're not on probation, if the police come to your front door, you don't have to answer the front door. Okay. Chances are they're there for a compliance check, not to arrest you. But on the other hand, you don't have to answer the front door. And why would I be telling you this? Because the fact is, if you answer the front door, if you open your front door, then the curious minds of law enforcement start working. And so they, in fact, can invite themselves. I'm sorry. They will ask you if, in fact, they can come into your home. And if you're not on parole and you're not on probation, you do not have to allow law enforcement into your home. And in fact, I recommend against letting them into your home, even if you think you have nothing to hide. Now, why would I say something like that? Because when law enforcement comes into your home, if they see something that they consider to be suspicious, right, that might be evidence of a crime, God only knows what it might be, then in fact they can search your home for probable cause. So, for example, before marijuana was legal, there were instances that law enforcement during a compliance check came into a home and they saw the rolling papers. So I don't smoke anything myself, but I understand some people roll their own tobacco cigarettes, but some people roll their own marijuana cigarettes. And in fact, the rolling papers then were used as probable cause to do a full search of the house, right? And gosh only knows what they might find, but you don't want to have that experience. Because my understanding is they're not very careful when they search your home, and it may look like a tornado has hit your home. So again, if you're not on parole, you're not on probation, if in fact the law enforcement shows up at your front door and they may or may not say this is a compliance check, you don't have to answer the door. Well, what happens if you don't answer the door? Chances are they will leave a note behind, leave a business card behind, and say, please contact us. Now, supposedly, the sole purpose of a compliance check is to make sure you live at the address that you've given to law enforcement, right? Okay, that's supposed to be the only reason. But sometimes they get creative on a compliance check. I've heard of people, law enforcement asking about all the details of the offense for which you're convicted, make comments about this, that, or the other, perhaps the color of your curtains, I don't know. But the fact is, you know what? They have no business being there other than to, in fact, ensure that you live there. So my recommendation as a lawyer is to step outside the front. If, okay, you can ignore them. That's option A. Option B is you can step outside your front door and close the front door behind you. And I recommend you do this even if you're going to lock yourself out of the house, because I'm sure you can figure another way to get back in. But the fact is that once the police look into your house, again, if they see anything that they think is suspicious, then they think that they have established probable cause, and then they can search your entire house, including your computer. Okay, so they start asking you strange and difficult questions. You can say, gosh, gee whiz, give them your name, rank, and serial number. My name is Janice Bellucci. I live here at whatever address I live at, and the fact is, that's who I am. And then say thank you. Now, you could also ask them if they have a search warrant. Okay. That's a legitimate question. When you do, try to be polite about it, right? Don't be hostile. Like, well, where's your search warrant? It's never really a good idea to tug at a leash, right? Or to argue with somebody too strenuously who has a gun on their hip. So at least that's my policy. You can create your own policy if you wish. But again, I just want to remind you that if somebody comes to your front door, even if they're from law enforcement, you do not have to answer the door unless you're on parole or unless you're on probation. So do I have any questions about that before I go on? I know it's something that I talk about on a regular basis, but it's just a really important reminder because it can be anxious, anxiety producing when somebody shows up at your front door with a pistol on their hip. I will say I did have a client who did probably all the wrong things in a compliance check. This is before he was my client because now, but I use him as an example and I don't mention his name. He said it was okay, where he basically let the law enforcement folks come right in his house, right? That's mistake number one. Because he said, oh, I have nothing to hide, come right in. So they did, right? And then once they were in his house, they saw that he had a desktop computer. And then they said, hey, can we look at your computer, see what's on your computer? Mistake number two, he said, oh yeah, sure. The cops were there for 45 minutes looking at his computer. And he was really, really lucky in that number one, they didn't find anything because he said there was nothing there. But even more importantly, the police did not add anything to his computer. Folks, this is something that we all have to be really careful about. Having other people have access to your computer it can be dangerous. And I know when my children were younger and they're living at home, I told them, no, you may not download things on my computer. You cannot use, the memory sticks, anything like that. No. Now, whether or not they did it, I don't know. But anyway, it's good to protect your computer and its contents. So I'm going to go ahead and move on then from the compliance checks. Wait a minute. Here's a question from Angela. I'm looking in the chat room right now, folks. Does this apply in all states if off paper? Yes. Or are PFRs required to answer the door in some states? That answer is no. And the reason I can say that with authority is because of the US Constitution, which in fact is in place in all states. So another person said, I only answered my door as I have contractors here doing work, and I thought it was them. What set me off was they started to go in my backyard and told them, you can't go back there. LOL, they said I have a bad attitude. I gave them a thumbs up and told them I have rights. I like that response. Anybody wants to borrow that, go right ahead. I'm in Georgia and in March got off supervision. Recently, the sheriff visited me for a verification check. Being off supervision, I did not take their visits well. I end up telling them to get off my property. And MH, you have the right to do that. Okay. And peeking in your window, by the way, going into your yard, I mean, that is your personal property. Some people I know choose to have a gate in the front yard or the backyard to make sure that they don't come on. Now, I will say one of the other, I know I said I was going to stop talking about this, but there's something else I do want to bring up. And so sometimes when the law enforcement shows up, they act like they're coming to arrest Boston Strangler or something. And they come, multiple officers show up with weapons. And if you're in a situation like an apartment, a condo project, or maybe even a townhome project, cross situation, then you might want to answer the door just to get them to go away. Because I have heard two of them going to neighbors' houses and asking questions too about the person on the registry, or asking your neighbors, well, did you know so and so, your neighbor is in fact on the registry. So there's nothing to stop them from doing that, by the way. And so that's one argument in favor of answering the door so they don't do something like that. Okay, people still joining us now. All right, so let's talk about what I think is going to be the main topic today, but we'll see how much folks have to say about it, and that's Halloween. So every October, I just am always surprised and many times disappointed by how the public acts about people on the registry on Halloween. Why am I saying that? Because there are many studies out there, there are government studies, there are academic studies that basically say no child in any jurisdiction has ever been sexually assaulted while trick-or-treating by a stranger. Okay, that's a really bold statement. That's a strong statement, and I mean it. Okay, this is not Janice's personal opinion. This is the result of research. So the researchers have said this has never happened before. So why in the heck is everybody such in arms about Halloween? Tell in many jurisdictions you can't decorate your house outdoors. You can't answer the door to trick-or-treaters. Some jurisdictions you can't even put your front porch light on Halloween. I mean, how ridiculous is it? And of course, the worst situation is when they have a Halloween sign requirement. So we being the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, we're on a campaign here, folks. We're on a campaign to get rid of Halloween signs nationwide. So in our very first case outside the state of California, was in the state of Missouri. And by the way, that case is still going on. But I have some really good news to share with you about it. So in the state of Missouri, it basically says that everybody who's on the registry had to post a sign on the front door of their home on Halloween. Okay. So, and it had certain language that had to be on the sign. The government didn't provide the sign. Each registrant had to make their own sign. So what's the danger of that? And I understand it's annoying, but the fact is it's downright dangerous. And that's why we've taken this on as a as a mission is to again get rid of Halloween sign requirements in the entire nation. Because the fact is, if you have a sign on your front door that basically says, I'm a sex offender, right? That's what, no matter what the wording says, that's what it means. I'm on the registry, I'm required to register. Then guess what? Neighbors are not going to forget the next day, next year, or anything else. They're not going to forget that there was a sign on your door. So they may or may not know that you're on their registry, but the fact is, you had to basically add your a scarlet letter to your house. And why in the heck would you do that? And Halloween is of all the times, it's such a strange holiday. As a kid, I never tricked anybody. I never conducted mischief. As a kid, I was much more interested in the candy. I don't know about you all, but that's what it was about for me. It's like, oh boy, candy. I sure hope I get a Snickers bar or, whatever it was that I liked at the time. But some people are up to conducting mischief, and that's being kind. Okay, so people, shoot guns, they light fires, or they shouldn't be. And so giving somebody a license, really, and giving them an enhanced opportunity, shall we say, to harm somebody on the registry is just wrong. It's really, really wrong. And by the way, they could harm people who live in your home with you. Well, many times it's your family members, right? It could be minors. It could be your parents. It could be your spouse, whatever, whoever's living in the home. Everybody is at danger with that sign on the front door, basically recognizing you or identifying yourself as somebody who's required to register. So that is why we're fighting so hard with this. Again, back to the state of Missouri, they're requiring every registrant to put a sign on the front door of their home on Halloween. Well, we did get a plaintiff in that case who was very upset about this. The fact is, he's having these huge Halloween parties for many years. And he even checked with law enforcement, not once but twice, to make sure that this new law that was passed in the state of Missouri did not apply to him because he had in fact been convicted prior to passage of that law. And he was assured twice in 2 different years that, oh no, it doesn't apply to you. And so he had these Halloween parties. And it was harmless fun. I mean, he had dry ice, he had skeletons, he had zombies, creatures. I mean, these were all like, some of them were mechanical, some of them were just made out of like a scarecrow straw, and that. And after having this for more than 10 years, and by the way, not putting a sign on the front door of his home for 10 years, the police decided that they were going to make an example of him. And in fact, that's what they did. So they arrested him for, on Halloween for having the party, but also for not having a Halloween sign. And so once he contacted us, then we went ahead and filed a lawsuit. And we filed the lawsuit in federal court. And I want you all to hear that. Federal court is where we filed the lawsuit because we were talking about a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Folks, I do not want to be fighting this out in state courts because state court judges in most jurisdictions are subject to re-election. Federal judges are appointed for life, right? And so they don't really care what the public thinks of them in most situations. And they have a stronger sense, I think, of the constitutional protections. So when we file our lawsuits challenging the Halloween sign requirements, we go to federal district court. And that's exactly what we did in Missouri. And it's been a long, hard fight with, by the way, we sued the Attorney General of Missouri, which is a bold thing to do at any point in time, but it was also necessary. So we sued the Attorney General. We also sued the police chief in the city where our plaintiff lived. And so I'm happy to report that earlier this month, on October 2nd, the federal district court judge granted a permanent statewide injunction. And I'll tell you what, federal judges are stingy with injunctions. And so it's I'm absolutely delighted that this federal judge agreed with us 100% and basically told the attorney general and oh, by the way, all local law enforcement that in fact their state law was unconstitutional. It violates the First Amendment because the sign is, quote, compelled speech. So for many people, when we think about the First Amendment, we're thinking about the right to speak, the right to say something we want to say. But there's another part of the First Amendment that's equally important, and that is compelled speech. So the fact is, the government cannot compel you to say something you don't want to say. So putting a sign on the front door of your home that basically says, I am a sex offender, you can imagine why people don't want to do that. And so when the government says, you must do this, or by the way, we will arrest you. And that's in fact what happened to the plaintiff in our case in Missouri. They arrested him. They took him into custody. He was in custody, I believe, less than a day. But the fact is, then he, in fact, he was charged with a misdemeanor, charged with and convicted of a misdemeanor offense. So misdemeanor, is that so bad? Maybe not. But the fact is, you shouldn't be charged with or convicted of anything when it comes to something like a Halloween sign. So, with this ruling that we got from the judge on October 2nd, you would think it's over, but it's not, because in fact, the Attorney General of Missouri has now filed a notice of appeal to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm not worried about the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, quite frankly. They were very they're supportive of our cause, of our position earlier. So what happened, just some background, last year in October of 2023, the same federal district court judge granted a temporary restraining order, also known as a TRO. And that was supposed to stop enforcement of the Halloween signs at that point in time. The attorney general did not like that TRO. And so the attorney general filed an emergency stay with the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Eighth Circuit's decision about that emergency stay was beautiful. It's almost like a poem, maybe even haiku, because it was only two sentences long. The first sentence of the Eighth Circuit decision was, you want to file a brief that's too long, Attorney General? Okay, that's okay with us. The second sentence says, and we deny your motion. So, short and sweet, said everything it needed to say. And so that's why, thank you, Rick. That's why I'm optimistic that the Eighth Circuit will, in fact, rule in our favor. But, sometimes you have to go through the motions. And one of the things the Attorney General said was, in fact, well, because it's an injunction and it involves a state law, they feel compelled to oppose what we've done so far. The fact that they filed, I just want to make sure everybody understands, the fact that they filed a notice of appeal is not the same as filing an appeal. So what they're doing right now is they're preserving their right to file an appeal later on. They're not required to file an appeal. And I think it's at least possible that they won't. If you think about the timing, it's right before Halloween and it's right before an. Okay, so filing a notice of appeal, it's one page document, right? It's like so easy to do to file a notice of appeal. And I've done it myself. And, of course, not this case, because we won this case. Why would we appeal it? But in a few other cases, I have filed a notice of appeal. And in one of those cases, we didn't go ahead with the appeal. And I can't even remember why. But there's always, a variety of reasons. So we'll see after Halloween and after the election, maybe the Attorney General of Missouri will change his mind. Not sure about that. Okay, so and by the way, I was able to file a case in Missouri because there is a local criminal defense attorney who his name is Matt Fry, Fry, and he was willing to serve as local counsel in the case. So he, we just need some money local, and he was a great local counsel. He did perform some duties, and I really appreciate Matt Fry for agreeing to serve as local counsel in the case. So that was the first time that we filed a lawsuit outside of California. The second time was in nearby Arkansas. So there's a county in Arkansas. It's called Marion, Marion County in Arkansas. And they did something even worse. So they thought that a sign on the door for one day was not nearly enough. So they said, no, you have to have the sign on the door for 2 weeks. Not one day, but 2 weeks. And this time, the registrant doesn't prepare the sign. The government provided the sign. Okay, so this is a government sign. It's, yeah, and it's being put on your front door, and it's for 2 weeks. So we said, heck no. And so we filed a lawsuit in Marion County, Arkansas, and we settled that case really quickly. And I'll tell you one of the reasons why, or I'll just tell you the reason why is the judge. So when the When we had a meet, the one and only meeting before the judge, it was great because it was telephonic and I didn't have to go to Arkansas. But the judge said, let me get this straight. Government, you're saying that this person volunteered to have the sign put on his front door? Let's explore that. Okay, so it was a deputy sheriff, yes, who had a badge, yes, and who had a gun on his hip, yes. And he said that basically the sign had to go up or the person's going to be arrested, yes. And the judge said, that doesn't sound like voluntary to me. Okay, and he was really straightforward judge. It was interesting. The attorney who was representing at that point in time Marion County, I'm not sure he spent much time defending cases in federal court because he made some big mistakes. But anyway, after we had that meeting with the judge, Marion County was only too happy to settle the case. And folks, the only way we settle these cases is that the government entity agrees that there will be no Halloween signs. Okay, so in Marion County, no Halloween signs. Okay, so, and by the way, Marion County is, its northern border is Missouri. This is how close these things are. Then there's another county in Arkansas. It's called Boone County, Boone, Boone County. And in Boone County, they're doing something very similar. I have a question here. Do you find that these things are due to the public being in an uproar about Halloween or simply due to political reasons? You know what? I'd say both. I really would. But about the public being in an uproar, absolutely. And folks, I mean, I don't remember how many years ago, it seems like a lot of years ago, when there was these stories about razor blades being found in apples that were being handed to kids on Halloween. You know what? They never even found one razor blade. So what? And it's the same thing here with saying that people on the registry pose a significant danger on Halloween to trick-or-treaters. It's nonsense, and that's being kind. A little early in the day for me to start swearing. So anyway, the fact is that no kid on Halloween has ever been sexually abused by by somebody on the registry while they're trick-or-treating. Never. It just hasn't happened. So your government is spending oodles of money, right? And all these compliance checks and all these requirements to have the Halloween signs and stuff. Because what good is it to have a requirement for Halloween sign if you don't have the cops in their in their cars patrolling the streets to make sure you put your Halloween sign in, right? And then, oh, heaven forbid, if you don't do it, then they're going to give you then they're going to arrest you, charge you with a crime, and probably convict you as well. So we've had two cases and two successes, even though the Mississippi case is not final yet. I will say that second county in Arkansas, Boone County, we had the lawsuit already filed. We had already written it and it was all ready to be filed when, in fact, the Boone County Sheriff's Department came out, took the sign down, Halloween sign down, and said, "We changed our mind." So that just happened yesterday on Friday. We're not sure why that happened. We're happy that the Halloween sign was taken down, and we don't know if it was only that one person, our plaintiff, or if it happened statewide. So stay tuned for that. But the fact is that we have not filed a lawsuit, at least not yet, in Boone County. So, folks, this is the time that I ask you to share with us, share with me, and remember it's being recorded, what might be happening where you live as far as Halloween restrictions. Are there Halloween sign requirements? Are they telling you that you can't decorate your house outside? What kinds of experiences are you having? Okay, crickets. Please raise your hand. I can't see everybody's photos at the same time. So if you would go down to the raise hand button below, that would be great. And if folks don't have anything to say about this, then we can move on. But Rick, you raised your hand. Please go ahead.
I've had several squads visit my house when I was on supervised release, and all they wanted to do was just make sure that I was live there. And so I answered their questions and said, "Yes, I do live here." And okay, thank you. And that was
Wonderful.
it.
Okay. Well, I think you're darn lucky. And you say supervised release, so you were convicted in federal court, right?
No, I'm sorry, I was on probation.
On probation? Okay.
Yeah.
And you were convicted in state court?
I was convicted in county court.
In county. Okay, that's state. Okay. It's either federal or state.
Oh, sorry, state, yes.
All right. JB, you have your hand up. Thank you for sharing that, by the way.
A quick question. You might want to mention something. If an individual here is on probation or parole, I know in the state of California, they can get a visit the evening of Halloween. Is that correct?
It depends on the jurisdiction. Some places it does happen, but it's not 100%. And folks, remember, if you're on parole or probation too, you may have a condition of parole or a condition of probation that says you have to stay indoors at night. You might say that, I don't know, at one point in time, I think it was down in San Diego here, they were making people on parole come and spend the night in a tent with law enforcement on a cot. I hope that's not happening anymore. And they called it Operation Boo. So, yeah. And again, to me, it's just such a waste of taxpayer dollars. And that's bad enough. But then to me, the even worse thing, of course, is you got the public all worried about something that's not a danger. And I'll tell you what, when my kids were young, I remember one time I was out with my younger daughter, trick or treating, and we almost got hit by a car. Right? That is so much more. That is a real danger on Halloween, is getting hit by a car. And by the way, it was dark and the car's headlights weren't even on. So, fortunately we weren't hit, and that, but you just don't know. But I mean, there's all kinds of studies that talk about how kids are in fact harmed on Halloween. And it's not by somebody on the sex offender registry. It's by a drunk driver. It's by somebody that I just described who didn't have his headlights on. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that children are in harm's way on Halloween, but it's not because, of people on the registry. Okay, so someone said, if someone is off probation, are there any restrictions in LA City? The answer is no. No. In California, if you are not on parole and you're not on probation, you can do any darn thing you want to do on Halloween. Okay. Here, someone says, I'm in Apple Valley, California, a tier one, never on parole or probation. This coming April will be my 12th year. Are you still representing us that want to end our registration? The answer to that is yes, but I don't want to talk about the details right now. Okay. I'll be talking about tiered registry a little bit later. Okay. All right. So I'm gonna, JB, I'm gonna lower your hand here. I don't see any more hands up. So I'm just gonna wish everybody a wonderful Halloween, and I hope that you don't get any visits by law enforcement or anybody else. Somebody says here in San Diego, while on federal supervised release, we are told we're not allowed to answer the door. I understand that that can be a condition of supervised release. If you have that condition, please comply with the condition. And I know at least in one situation, somebody was baited, where in fact the law enforcement came to the front door and somebody pretended like they were a kid or something with a little hot squeaky voice, trick-or-treat, and the person answered the door. So folks, don't do it. Okay. Somebody else got in trouble because they had candy bars. Turns out they like candy bars, right? Who doesn't? So the fact is, they tried to bust him for having candy bars. I mean, this is how ridiculous it can be. And let me talk about a situation that in fact existed in San Diego. And by the way, I graduated from law school in San Diego. I undergraduate San Diego State University, graduate, my law school, University of San Diego. So I have some San Diego connections, and I can't understand why they're so stupid in San Diego, they being law enforcement. Because one time, and this was an early lawsuit that we filed, by the way, there are no Halloween restrictions in California. No, certainly no sign requirements if you're not on parole and not on probation. So, but at one point in time, our Department of Corrections was requiring people to have Halloween signs on their residence, right? So the front door, let's say you lived in a single family home and the front door of your home, apartment, front door of the apartment, townhouse, front door of the townhouse. But it kept going down the food chain. So if you, all the way down to, if you were living in a tent, they told you you had to put the sign on the flap of your tent. If you were living in your car, on the windshield of your car, and honest to God, they said, if in fact you were living, sleeping in a sleeping bag on the street, you're supposed to put the Halloween sign on your sleeping bag. And I said, I don't think so. And we sued them and we won. So, I mean, this is how stupid law enforcement can be when they don't get challenged. All right. And so for many years before our organization existed, law enforcement did whatever they pleased, right? Because most people in the registry have limited means and can't afford to file a lawsuit. But here we are. And I just want to remind you that Axol is here for you. We're here to support you. We're here to bring you hope. And whenever necessary, quote, to sue the bastards. So, okay. Any more questions about Halloween before we move on? Oh, you're welcome, Angela. Thank you. All right, so let's talk about something else that's exciting. Let's talk about SORNA. I know it was on the list. I really don't have any updates about SORNA. That case is taking so darn long. I have no freaking idea why, except for the fact that I believe this federal district court judge knows that no matter how he rules in the case, he's going to be the case. The decision's going to be appealed, right? So he's acting like super, super carefully, dotting every I, crossing every T, because he knows that they're going to take it up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This judge has, in fact, is open-minded. I have appeared before him before in two other cases, and I found him to be open-minded. He listens. He actually reads our documents. And that might sound strange for me to say that, but I swear sometimes the judges don't bother to read the Bruce Lee file. So anyway, he does, and he's thoughtful. And he also issued a preliminary injunction in that case. So at least the residents, the people on the registry living in California, do not have to comply with SORNA. Okay. So that is a small blessing. I wish that he'd been even bolder and basically issued something for the entire nation, but he didn't. So we're stuck with, we're protected in California, and the other states, unfortunately, you're stuck with at least the possibility of SORNA. The biggest issue in that case, by the way, and I'm bringing this up because everybody should be concerned about this if indeed you're on the registry or you're not on the registry anymore. So the government's position in this SORNA case is that we don't care even if you're, let me put it a different way. They think that anybody who has ever been convicted of a sex offense, I mean ever convicted of a sex offense, even if you're no longer required to register, that you too should in fact be subject to SORNA. And there's some SORNA requirements that are so draconian, no one should have to comply with them. But that's what it is. So this is the big battle that's going on. And it's also something, the bigger issue, constitutional issue, has to do with separation of powers. So if you remember from high school, knowing that there's three branches of government, right? And basically it's supposed to be a check and balance system so that one part of government doesn't hold all the power or even too much power. And so the main argument here in the case is, in this situation, the Attorney General of the United States has too much power, okay, and is in fact kind of judge and jury in the cases. So we'll see where in fact that case goes, but for right now, that's what we're talking about. I would like to bring up the conference, our Axol conference, before I go on to the next topic. The Axol conference was virtual this year. It was an experiment. I think we succeeded in our experiment in having a virtual conference. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback from people who said, it certainly costs a lot less money to watch something on your computer screen, or even if you could just listen in, as compared to flying to Los Angeles, renting a hotel room and the like. And so the jury's still out, certainly for next year, whether or not we'll have a virtual conference or an in-person conference. So maybe this is a time to ask people to weigh in. Regardless of whether or not you attended the conference this year, what do you think? Do you have a preference for virtual conference versus an in-person conference? Hands, please. Should I ask for a vote? Penny, you have an opinion. Excellent. Please unmute yourself and express your opinion. Hi. No, Penny, can you unmute yourself, please?
Yeah.
There you go. Fabulous.
So, no, I just, you asked if anybody had an opinion. I think that if you're trying to encourage people to attend conferences and become educated, oftentimes the barrier is financial. So it's nice to be able to attend virtually and to hear other, what other people are doing, what other people are thinking, the research out there. That just supports what we're trying to do.
Okay. Yeah. I think those are really valid points. And having said that, we've got a vote here for an in-person conference. So it's neck and neck, guys and women. One in favor of in-person, one in favor of virtual. And yeah, please let us know. Lauren, you have your hand up. Oops. Lauren, can you unmute yourself, please? I think I muted you back.
There you go. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Perfect. Hi, Janice. How are you today, first of all?
Great, thank you.
Good, good. I attended the conference, of course, virtually, and I thought the format was very good because, once again, not every topic related to every individual. So, given the options of room one, room two, it was very convenient, which, of course, with that said, you were able to get multiple topics covered at the same time, so you were able to get more speakers. I think the format worked really well, and me personally, I got a lot out of it and was able to pick and choose, again, which topics were most important to me.
Okay, thank you so much. We have a comment, actually, two people basically asking about a hybrid conference. We can't do it with the current resources. We did look into that. I'll tell you one of the things that specifically we looked into was having a hybrid conference at a hotel near the Los Angeles airport. It would have cost us $70,000, 70. $1,000 to have a hybrid conference. And, folks, one of the things that's really important to us is to keep the price of the conference as low as possible. I mean, where else can you go to a 2-day conference for $25? I don't know of any places. My legal conferences I have to attend, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we're mindful of that too. If somebody knows the technology that might be possible to do it a different way, then please share it with us. The other thing is, we don't have a large staff. So the fact is, the conference that you all saw, those of you who did, or if you watched the recordings, we had three people and four computers. No, we had three people and six computers. Okay, so three computers were dedicated solely to recording each and every one of the rooms of the conference. And so everything that was said was recorded. Okay, so that was good. And that was three computers on the side. And then myself and two other people, we also had our own computers that were recording the entire time in different rooms. So Zoom does make things a heck of a lot easier. But it's not without paying a price. And so I'm glad most people have given, just practically everybody has given us positive feedback about the conference, and that kind of weighs toward having a virtual conference next year. On the other hand, I'm one of those people that loves to chat with people in the hallway, so I miss that. I guess I'll just have to do more Saturday conferences or Zoom meetings. Okay, somebody else says, if we can't do hybrid, she votes virtual. It was excellent. I got to watch some videos afterward. Virtual is great then. I prefer virtual. It was great last month. I liked the virtual conference and found the format great and the topics interesting. How many attended the virtual versus precious years? I think you mean previous years in person. You know what? The number of people signing up was about the same. So it was about 200. So, okay. And I will say another thing is with the speakers preferred the virtual because then they could come in, speak. They were invited to join the conference if they wanted as a participant, but many people did not. They came in, they spoke for their hour 15, and then they did whatever else they were going to do. So in other words, and the other thing that certainly needs to say, in fact, that having people nationwide be able to participate in our conference at the lowest cost possible. Here, for those of us that live out of state, I vote for virtual because of cost. And I've attended both the live and virtual conferences, and I vote virtual. Wow, that's a strong message. One of the things too, and this is kind of a joke, kind of not, is we don't have to worry about how many donuts to bring to the conference. And then last year, the second day, we didn't. There was a mix-up with the people who were supposed to deliver the coffee. I'm one of those coffee drinkers. I'm like, what do you mean we don't have any coffee in the second day? So anyway, don't have to worry about coffee either. We get to provide our own. All right. So any last comments or questions here about this year's conference or what your preference would be for next year? Okay, great. All right. So let's get back to the meat of the thing, the topics. I think I'd like to bring up a topic. And just say, this is something we're going to start researching. And if you have any information about it, hope you'll share it with us. It has to do with registrants who are being denied access to, for lack of a better term, old folks' homes, right? Assisted living facilities. And I know this was something that was brought up during the conference. So we had one panel in particular where we had people from four different organizations and four different states talk about this. And it was amazing to me that they all brought it up. In California, I have not been very aware of what's going on here. And so this is something definitely we're going to start looking at AXL in California, but other states as well. And then, once I start thinking about that, then I was like, well, I've heard stories about Florida. And in Florida, supposedly, people on the registry are not even allowed to go into the hurricane shelters. And how awful and terrible is that? And then there's a really awful story that was at least 5 years ago where somebody on the registry literally froze to death outside a shelter because they would not let him inside. So I'm just abhorrent. It's like, what adjective can I use here? It's abhorrent. I mean, man's inhumanity to man. You're not going to let somebody into a shelter knowing full well that they could in fact freeze to death outside. And that's what happened. So, it's just shocking to the conscious. And so that's something again that we're going to start looking into, see what changes, if any, we can make. I don't know the answer to that. But if you look at the research from Dr. Carl Hansen, one of the things his research illustrates quite strongly is that basically the older that we get, the less likely anybody is to commit a sexual offense, right? And so I think it's like after the age of 60, it's practically zero. So what the heck? So you're going to tell somebody who's 75 years old that they can't get care at an old folks home. It just again blows my mind. So sigh. If you have any information about this, if you're working with seniors, if you know that this has happened anywhere, please share that with me later. Okay, here somebody says Florida offers separate shelters just for SOs. All right. Oh, and somebody on that panel too who was from Florida. He said what happens when there's not a shelter available for like during a hurricane, and they've had two big ones this year already, that they tell them to go to the jail. The jail go to jail. And the jail's safe. So go check yourself in the jail. I guess it's better than being blown away in a hurricane, but what a choice to have to make, right? Let's see, get blown away by a hurricane or go to jail. Anyway, I don't know if that's for sure for true or not. Here we go. In Pennsylvania, I'm getting contacted more and more from social workers. Whoops, just lost that. At state correctional institutions regarding inmates that are aging with physical limitations and can't get released because they won't be accepted anywhere. Heartbreaking. I definitely agree with that comment, Lisa. Thank you for sharing. Veterans cemetery cannot be buried in some veterans cemetery. Oh my God, I know that to be true. And our former U.S. Senator here in California, Barbara Boxer, she is the one who initiated the legislation, and I hold many things against her, and that's number one. I'm a veteran myself. I don't plan to be buried anywhere, but if I were to be buried, I would think that I would want to be buried in a cemetery. And the fact that they're not going to allow somebody to be buried in a veteran cemetery solely because you were convicted of a sex offense? Come on, folks, that makes absolutely no sense. Okay, in California, it's tough. I assisted one person, and most nursing homes would not accept him. I finally found a boarding care location for him. Well, that's good to find that out. That's JB. Maybe you can share that information with me, JB, where you actually found him some care because, again, yeah. I had an inmate in federal that passed was a vet but buried in Potter's Field. I don't know what Potter's Field is. Is that a veteran cemetery? Maybe you can answer in the chat there. Okay, so some days I'll just share this with you all. Some days I feel overwhelmed. Okay, when I find out about issues like this, I definitely feel overwhelmed. There's only one of me. I do have an assistant, and I do talk to other attorneys all the time. I'm always out there recruiting other attorneys to join us in our cause. But there's so much work that needs to be done. So please don't give up. Please know that we're here to give you hope. And if anything, just call me for goodness sake. I answer my own phone. Call me and I will listen to you for at least 30 minutes. Okay. All right. I think we might have talked about that enough. Unless somebody else has something they want to add. There's a new message, two new messages. I had in, no. Oh, it's for the poor. In California, it's tough. I assist. No, that's you, JB. Florida does offer. Oh, good grief. All right. So some people are asking to the details be shared in a chat room. So folks, please do that. That's a great way to share information. Okay. So especially if it's something you don't necessarily want to be recorded, put it over there in the chat room. We don't record what's in the chat room. I don't think there's any way to retain that at all. Okay. All right. So let's go on to the next happiest topic, right? But before I do, I want to mention that we are going to have a vigil in Washington, D.C. It will be on or about March 5th of next year. I hope that everybody who is here today, plus everybody who listens to it in the future, will come join us. It's really, really important that we remind this U.S. Supreme Court that they made a mistake in the year 2003. When they issued the decision Smith versus Doe. So just in case you have never heard of Smith versus Doe, I'll give you a brief summary. So Smith versus Doe said that the requirement to register is not punishment. So that should be shocking enough for you to hear. Registration is not punishment. Why is it that it's hard to find a job? Why is it that it's hard to find housing? Why is it that you feel like a leper? Oh, it's not punishment. Just remember that the US Supreme Court said so. Okay, so if it's not punishment, why is that statement important? The statement is important because then if it's not punishment, then government at every level, and I do mean every level, so we're talking about cities and counties, the state and the federal government, right? They can pass new laws and apply them retroactively. It was like, I hope that's shocking to you, because I mean, if you think about it, what if there were no laws about red lights, right? And so you're like, well, I think I'll stop today, or I don't think I'm going to stop today. But it's not against the law not to stop, right? And then all of a sudden, somebody arrests you for not stopping at a red light 3 years ago. What? I mean, this is how ridiculous it is. And I often pick on Frank Lindsay, who was the one that got me involved in this organization because I read his book. I'm always blaming Frank. Anyway, who was my plumber at the time. The fact is that when he pled guilty to a sex offense, it was in 1979. And 1979, there was no internet. Okay, how could we live without an internet? Somehow we all survived. We did. Well, many of us have survived. But the fact is, when Megan's Law was passed, all of a sudden Frank's information was put on a public website, right? If you're on the registry now, chances are your information is on a public website. Your name, your photograph, might even be your street address is on this website, might be your employer. I mean, all kinds of information gets put on the Megan's Law website. And so somebody, broke into Frank Lindsay's house and a complete stranger who tried to kill him only because he was on the registry and because his name, photograph, and street address were posted on this public website. So U.S. Supreme Court, don't tell me this isn't punishment. It's punishment. Okay. And so we have to continue to educate the U.S. Supreme Court about the mistake that they made and the consequences, the results of that mistake. So this will be the third annual D.C. Vigil. Please come join us. It's safe to do it. The only thing is we don't know about the weather, so dress warmly in layers. Last year or this year in 2024, we had mild weather. 2023, it was a little cold and windy. So it's in March because that's the anniversary date. It's March 5th is the anniversary date. And it's an eye-opening experience. And for everybody who's participated, they told me that they feel empowered. Okay. And yes, I will be there and I will rant and rail at one person in particular, and that's John Roberts. And so for those of you who don't know, the John Roberts, who represented the state of Alaska in the Smith versus Doe case, he's now the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. You know what? He needs to own up to the fact that he made a mistake. Because guess what he said during oral argument in that case? When he was asked by a Supreme Court justice, well, isn't being on the registry like the same as applying for membership in Price Club? Price Club. Costco, Sam's Club, you know, we have different names in different locations. And he said yes. John Roberts said yes, it is similar. It's like, really? My best guess is John Roberts has never been in Price Club, Costco, Sam's Club, any of these places, and he's never applied for membership. Oh, by the way, he sure as heck has never been on the registry, right? So come on, let's get real here. And one of the craziest things about this is that the decision is based upon, in part, an article that was in Psychology Today magazine. What? Since when do we take statements in Psychology Today magazine as to be the truth? And it didn't say, oh, I've done the study for 20 years, like Dr. Carl Hansen. It was a man who was basically making a marketing statement saying, yeah, people come to me, I will be able to reduce the rate of reoffense. And he said it was frighteningly high, up to 80% rate of reoffense. Nonsense. It's not true. It's never been true. And yet the U.S. Supreme Court put it right in the opinion. The rate of reoffense is frightening and high. It's up to 80%. And trust me, when I litigate, I get that, you know, thrown in my face time after time. So who cares if it gets thrown in my face? The fact is it's not true. And we need U.S. Supreme Court decisions to be based on the truth. Now, has the U.S. Supreme Court ever made a mistake before? Yes, they have. yes, they have. The fact is that there are two cases I'll bring up real quickly. One is called Korematsu with a K. Korematsu, basically, the U.S. Supreme Court said, you want to people of Japanese descent in camps? Go right ahead. No big deal. The U.S. Supreme Court said that was okay. I will tell you that my roommate in law school, both of her parents had in fact been in the camps because they were of Japanese descent. And so every time I hear that, even now, I get angry again. So that's nonsense. Okay, another one that's more widely known is called Plessy versus Ferguson. At least that part is not so well known, but that was the decision that the U.S. Supreme Court said separate but equal education. That's fine. So what if kids don't have books to read, the school books? What if they don't have pencils and paper? Who cares? It's separate but equal. It's fine. And it took over 50 years for Plessy versus Ferguson to be overturned. And most people know about the case where it was overturned, and that is, in fact, Brown versus Board of Education. So the U.S. Supreme Court overturns decisions, right? There was some very controversial one just recently. And so we need to basically request or actually demand that the U.S. Supreme Court fix this mistake that they made. You know, from the court's perspective, hey, it's only been 11 years. But think of all the harm that's been done by all these new laws that have been passed and applied retroactively. So I'm in a one-person crusade to overturn that. I have gotten myself admitted to the U.S. Supreme Court's Bar Association so that I am, quote, eligible to argue a case before that court. Who knows if I will ever do it? But the fact is I'll get the opportunity. But if not, I'll carry the briefcase of anybody who does, and I'll buy them dinner, too. So anyway, here we go. The new federal regulation has a direct link to cancel any membership you wish to discontinue. So one person says, well, then just cancel my membership in Costco, Megan's List, International Megan's List, et cetera. I like that. And somebody else says, hopefully we don't have to wait 50 years. Absolutely. The new federal regulation now has a direct link to cancel any membership you wish to discontinue. And as a 290 at 26 years old, it's been the most difficult thing I've ever had to endure. I caught this conviction due to a girl lying about her age, even when I won't even say the rest of it. So if the SOR is like signing up for Price Club, then we should be able to cancel it, right? I would agree, right? And one of the things that one of our members did several years ago, he put together just the California laws that apply to somebody in the registry. And it was three ring binders full of documents, right? Of these laws, these state laws, and also, you know, city laws, county laws, et cetera, federal laws. And so he slammed that on a table one time and said, yes, this is it. This is the Price Club application. So I don't know about you all, but when I hear something so ridiculous, it just makes me want to fight to change it. I mean, this is how the system is broken. We all know that. You know, whether it's Halloween, that's one day of the year, but any other things. I think in Florida, somewhere in Florida, I don't think it's statewide, you can't even dress up as Santa Claus. Did you know that? If you're on the registry, you can't dress up as Santa Claus. I mean, and I'm not talking about at a department store. I'm just talking about at home for your grandkids, for goodness sake. So that's how ridiculous this is. Okay. Alrighty. So does anybody have any questions now about that topic before I move on? And if there's something I'm not covering that you would like to cover, please put it in the chat. I'll do my best to cover it. We're about an hour into it, about another hour to go. If I can handle, excuse me, I'm going to cough now. Well, so I warned people who came on early that I have a cold. And so whether it's coughing or sneezing, I'd like not to do it in front of others. So that's why I disappeared for a moment. Okay, I'm back. And so that was talking about the DC Vigil. So March of next year, please join us if you possibly can. So let's talk about another case here in California. And I think that it could be used as a precedent in other places, and that's why I'm going to mention it for sure. So our Department of Corrections, in their infinite wisdom, and yes, that is sarcasm, decided to violate state law. Isn't it great when your Department of Corrections breaks the law? The Department of Corrections basically violated state law by requiring registrants on parole to undergo treatment the entire time they're on parole. Okay. And that's not what the law said. The law said a minimum of 1 year of treatment. It didn't say what the maximum was, but then it said after that, what's supposed to happen is people are supposed to come together and make a decision about whether or not additional treatment was supposed to be, it would be required. It's supposed to be on a case by case basis. But instead, what the Department of Corrections did is they had an informal policy. I mean, an unwritten policy, right? That every registrant, the entire time they're on parole, they have to undergo treatment. Now, that's bad enough because you're going to get stuck in group meetings and individual meetings, undergo polygraphs, all this other stuff, for up to 20 years, by the way. So some people in California have 20-year parole. So for 20 years, you're going to have to do all this nonsense, right? And the other thing is that even though you're required by law to be considered for early discharge from parole, it's not going to happen because, ta-da, you're undergoing treatment. Okay, so Department of Corrections basically requires you to undergo treatment, and then the Bureau of Parole Hearings basically denies you the right to early discharge because you're undergoing treatment. So we said, I don't think so. We sued them, and we won. And it was interesting because I have I've sued Department of Corrections many times. By the way, I have 100% success rate. They know who I am. Okay. So with this one, we sued them, but they've never in the past admitted they made a mistake. They listen, make us drag this out in trial and everything. Right. And so this time, for the first time, they said, you're right. we did something we shouldn't have done. They didn't admit they broke the law, but they admitted they did something they shouldn't have done. And then they said, what will it take to settle the case? And so we entered into a very formal settlement agreement. It's been blessed by the court. And one of the things that was the main thing that was required was that they had to do things differently. So the new regulations, these brand new regulations came out on Monday of this week on October 14th. And in those regulations, it basically says, in fact, there's every person, every registrant on parole will be evaluated every single year, and a determination will be made whether or not additional treatment is required. So I would think about the state law says a minimum of 1 year, doesn't say what the maximum is. And the thing is, now there has to be a case-by-case basis every single year whether or not additional treatment's required. Now, that's good. But let me tell you what's even better. And it says, and they have to put their decision in writing, and they have to give their registrant a copy of the decision. Now, why is that important? Because then you can give me a copy of that decision, and if it's unreasonable, guess what? We can take them to court. Okay, so there's going to be some feedback process here. So I've read the regulations. They're posted on the AXAW website, and I really am happy with the regulations. They more or less say what needs to be said. But this is why am I not bringing out and popping the champagne cork? Because I'm concerned they're not going to implement the regulations. So it's one thing to publish regulations. The next thing is whether or not they're going to be implemented. So I'm already hearing some nonsense. I use that word a lot, right? Because that keeps me from swearing. Some nonsense here. And somebody's treatment provider saying, I don't care what those regulations say. You are going to be in treatment for 3 years. Huh. What kind of case-by-case evaluation is that? Is like, no matter what you do, you're going to be in treatment for 3 years? I don't think so. So anyway, and as you can imagine, we've probably upset some people who are treatment providers. We've upset some people who are parole officers, because guess what? They're not going to have so many people to supervise parole. They're not going to have so many people getting paid money for treatment, right, anymore. So I know in a different lifetime when I worked for the Air Force, the fact is that they call them rice bowls. So we've broken a lot of rice bowls. I don't know what's going to happen, right? And so there could be a battle from the treatment providers, from the parole officers, or God only knows who. But the good news is, and I am an optimist by nature, is we have some good regulations, and let's see whether or not they're properly implemented. Now, there is one thing in there, and I actually wrote a comment on our website today, because one of the things that says, that I'm going to pull them out here, one of the things that says here in the regulations, they talked about the three phases, curriculum phase, maintenance phase, and then the last one, which they call the aftercare phase. So the aftercare phase is voluntary. Okay, so you've already completed treatment, but you're going to volunteer to stay in the aftercare, to participate in the aftercare phase, even though whatever you say or do in the aftercare phase is going to be reported to a parole officer. Really? And you have to pay for it. So as I said, let's add insult to injury that these little people are going to go run back to your parole officer and tell the parole officer whatever you say in aftercare, and you have to pay for this too. So I would never do that if it was my decision. I would hire somebody privately if I thought I needed more counseling, and I would not want anybody to go back to my parole officer or anybody in the government for that matter. So anyway, I know a lot of people have contacted me before these regulations came out, since the lawsuit was decided, since we settled the lawsuit. Does anybody have any questions right now that they'd like to ask me about the regulations? And I'm going to turn off the video, but I'm going to be listening because I need a sip of water right now. Wow, I guess different people are are not on the call today, because I've just been inundated really by questions about this. So, you know, really it has to do with how they are implemented. Okay, somebody says in the chats, there can never be true rehabilitation if one is on the partner registry hang down your head, you Tom Dooleys, for the rest of your lives on the federally sanctioned vigilante sworn registry. I'm just reading folks a comment. I'm not saying that I agree with it. You mentioned non-child related 290 convictions are not required to give 21-day notice for international travel. However, LAPD emailed me that I'm required. I blind copied you. I'm not on parole or probation. Please advise. Thanks. Let's take that offline, please. I don't think you want me to give the answer on a recorded phone call here. And folks, I'm going to put my email address and my phone number here in the chat room, just in case you don't have it. Just to warn you, I answered with my own phone. And if I don't answer the phone, please leave a message. And I don't have the world's best secretary. That would be me. So if I don't call you right back, you can call me again. Okay. So let's talk about something else that is California-based, but I think also mentioned is applicable to other states, and that's our tiered registry law. So we got a tiered registry law passed here in California. It only took 7 years. A little bit of sarcasm there. People in Sacramento, our state capital, say that was fast, but it seemed awfully slow to me. The tiered registry law that actually passed and was enacted into law wasn't good enough, quite frankly. It was something, but it wasn't good enough. So it's like you have no bread, they give you half a loaf of bread. Well, I'm grateful for the half a loaf, but darn it, I want the rest of the loaf now. Okay, so we're going to go back to the state legislature next year, and we're going to ask them for more slices of bread. And the biggest category of people, quite frankly, are people convicted of possessing child pornography. Okay, so we have 10,000, 20,000 people in California who are on a registry for possession of child pornography. This is the weird thing. It's the only thing I know where the federal government is more lenient than the state government. So in California, our state government right now puts you on tier three, which is the highest of the three tiers, and that means you are not eligible to petition for removal. What? It's a non-contact, non-violent offense. Why in the heck would you be on the highest tier? It makes no sense, right? And my alarm bells go off when it's like, this doesn't make sense. Why are things happening this way? I know why in this particular instance, because it was a political compromise. Okay. And talking about rice bowls, what I did a couple minutes ago, there's a lot of rice bowls here too. Okay, so I always have this vision about a cop and maybe a big, fat, dumb cop who has his shoes on the desk, right, drinking a cup of coffee and maybe eating a donut, watching some blips on a computer, right? And that's how they do this. They're watching these blips on a computer because, in fact, a lot of these files with child pornography have cookies on them. And so they can see on their computer where these blips are popping up, on whose computers. I mean, they don't really know. They don't have a name to begin with. It's like a... some computer guru can tell me IPN. Is that right? Rick says yes. Okay, good. I guessed correctly. So these are the people who are getting paid a lot of money to look at blips on a computer. And guess what? Nobody's got a gun. Nobody's going to shoot at them, right? When they're sitting at their desk drinking the coffee and eating a donut and looking at blips on a computer. So I can understand why they'd rather do that than face a bad guy out on the street that might shoot them. But on the other hand, this is ridiculous, okay? It's really, really ridiculous. And there's a couple, I have many thoughts about this. Number one is there should be a warning. Before somebody views child pornography, there should be a warning that says what you're about to look at is child pornography. And oh, by the way, you could end up going to jail or prison for this. I don't know, it wouldn't stop everybody, but at least it would stop some people. And I think the equivalent is the warnings on cigarette packs, right, that say smoking a cigarette can hurt you or kill you. Well, it doesn't stop everybody, but maybe it stops some people. So we have people who, honest to God, I understand, are addicted to pornography. And that's how some people end up accessing child pornography, because they're so addicted, they just can't stop themselves. Okay. And because of that, I think in the court system, we need to have a diversionary program for people who access child pornography. The first time, you get your hand slapped. Maybe you have to go to some classes or something, but the first time should not end up in federal prison. And that's what's happening so many times. And there's federal guidelines out there, and man, you are going to spend a lot of time in prison if in fact you have possessed child pornography. And I'm not making excuses for anybody. I really am not. I think it's abhorrent to be looking at child pornography. But on the other hand, if in fact you have this addiction and you need some help, then let's get you some help. Now, if you do it again, then go to prison. But the first time, anyway, I think in fact there should be a diversionary program, and people should be given an opportunity to in fact be helped. Okay. So other changes, we have some of this quirk in California law. The same actions, lewd or lascivious acts against a minor, there's two different subsections, 288A and 288C. 288A, your victim is under the age of 14. That's considered a tier two offense. On the other hand, if it's the same actions and the victim is older, you're on tier three, the highest tier. Does that make sense? That doesn't make sense to me. Okay, so the fact is that we need to get people who are the 288Cs off of tier three and down to tier two. My concern in doing this is in fact that the legislature, in their infinite wisdom, aka stupidity, they might take the people from 288As and move them up to 288 to tier three, which will be terrible, and we can't allow that to happen. So, and one particular reason I say that is we have about 40,000 people on our California registry who've been convicted of 288A. 40,000 people. We sure as heck do not want them to be elevated to tier three. So we need to get the 288Cs down to 288, to tier two. Easy for me to say. Okay. It's great. We have been working with the Sex Offender Management Board in California. We don't always agree with what they say or do, but guess what? They've agreed with us that this tiered registry law needs to be fixed. And they also brought up a category of offenses that has to do with it's 288.2, 288.3, 288.4, sharing harmful material with adolescents. Oh, give me a break. I am a female, I'm not a male, but I understand that many males, your father, or maybe a little brother or cousin or somebody showed you a copy of Playboy magazine when you're a teenager, right? Okay, so what? Now it's a crime. Oh my God, you've got to be kidding me. So those are the 288.2, 0.3, 0.4 categories and everything. And so the Sex Offender Management Board came up with that on their own, that they think that those offenses should be moved down to tier one. And I started telling you about the child pornography possession offenses in the federal government. If you're convicted of just merely possessing child pornography, it's considered tier one under the federal system. That is the only example I know where you get treated better under the federal system. Did somebody have a comment or question there? I'm looking through the.
Oh.
Hi. Do you have a question or a comment, sir? I think that's a male voice. Okay, maybe not. Greg, let me mute you if you don't mute, if you're not planning to speak.
Oh.
Do you have a question or a comment, Greg? Okay, I'm going to mute him, I think. There we go. It worked. Okay, so and some people have asked me about this difference between the federal system and the state system, and especially when it comes to possession of child pornography. Folks, it doesn't. Okay, and they're like, well, I'm going to move out of California or whatever other state is not sort of compliant so that I can be on tier one. Well, good luck, because that means you're going to have to comply with all the other provisions of SORNA. You don't want to do it. The SORNA provisions are terrible, they're draconian. And by the way, if you violate any of the provisions, you could end up in federal prison for up to 10 years. So think about it hard before you decide something like that. I really think that we have a good opportunity next year with the state legislature to get changes, improvement. I'll call them improvements to the tiered registry law. We shall see. This is Janice's crystal ball. Because we do have the Sex Offender Management Board on our side, we're working with other organizations as well, including the California Attorneys for Criminal Justice. And for the very first time, Axel has hired a lobbyist. And I've lobbied as an amateur or up to this point in time, like 14 years. But we hired somebody who, in fact, has 20 plus years of experience in the California state capitol, right? He knows the people. They know him. He's got a great reputation. He's not shying away from our topic at all. We're really pleased that he is willing to represent us. And we need him to help us guide us here, especially in the beginning of the process, because at this point in time, we don't have an author for the bill and we don't have a sponsor for the bill. The author is always a member of the state legislature. The sponsor is somebody who's not. And like in the original tiered registry law, the district attorney of Los Angeles was in fact the sponsor of the bill. And then Senator Scott Wiener was the author. So anyway, we've got a lot of work to do between now and then. The state legislature in California right now is in recess. I've signee die. Anyway, they're not working until next January. So they have their break here. We have an election coming up in just a few weeks, right? And after the election, we'll know who the actual members of the legislature are. It's really hard to try to go find an author for your bill when you don't know if they're going to be elected or reelected. So, and the other thing from that I'm remember, trying to remember, remind myself of is Scott Wiener was a brand new state senator when he became the author of the tiered registry law. That was a really brave thing for him to do. I don't know if it was brave or stupid of him, but he did it and we got it passed, right? Even after only 7 years. So there's a lot of change here on the horizon. I think in California, whatever happens next year would not be come effective until the following year. So I'm looking at 2025 as the year that we can persuade the legislature to improve the tiered registry law, and then the changes would become effective in 2026. Okay. And I'm really thinking that there's going to be tens of thousands of people who, in fact, benefit from the improvements to the tiered registry law. And by the way, this same lobbyist, by the way, the one we just hired, we hired him to help us with the tiered registry law next year, but you know what? He had something more important to do first, as it turned out. We had a bill that was pending, Senate Bill 1128. And Senate Bill 1128, if it had been passed as it was written, it would have added 30,000 new people to the state legislature, or to the registry, rather. 30,000 people. Many states don't even have a total of 30,000 people on the registry. We have about 103,000 right now. So another 30,000 people. People, by the way, who've never had to register in the past. And all of a sudden, for the first time, they'd have to register. By the way, our State Department of Justice, who I rarely agree with, but I agreed with them on this one. They didn't want that to happen either because they're like, oh my gosh, how do we find these people, that were convicted so long ago? So anyway, we dodged a bullet there and our lobbyist helped us. At one point in time, we were willing to enter into a compromise on the bill and he advised, he said, don't compromise, don't compromise. It's too early. Don't compromise. It's kind of like playing poker, I guess, right? And so he's like, no, don't do it yet. I'm like, okay, are you sure? And he said, yes. So anyway, the fact is the bill was stopped. I was stopped in the next to the last step in the legislative process. It was a nail biter for sure. But that's what a lobbyist can do for you and the experience that they have. Okay. Tiered registry law. I'm available for anybody that has a question about this. No one's asked yet, but let me talk about once you get off the registry. Okay. So, I've had 108 people, 108 of my clients so far are no longer required to register. There's been a lot more than that who have gotten relief under the tiered registry law. Not as many people as could, though some people are just waiting for for time to pass, before they are eligible to petition. So positive things are happening under the tiered registry law. Not enough is happening under the tiered registry law. We have a couple of jurisdictions who basically they're objecting to each and every petition. If in fact a petition is objected to, then guess what happens? Then there's a hearing. But if the DA does not object to your petition, there's no hearing, and the judge must grant your petition. So when, I'm holding my breath for every petition that I file. And by the way, I filed about 150 of them now. The rest of them are still pending. But the fact is that, always waiting for the DA to weigh in. And if the DA does not object, then the court must grant the petition. But oh, I know I was mentioning a couple of jurisdictions that they automatically object to every petition. I was able to help somebody in the public defender's office here in California. And prior to my helping her, she'd lost every case, every petition. And once I helped her and showed her what we do when a DA objects to a petition, and guess what? Now she's winning every case, and the DA is not objecting to as many. Amazing. Amazing how that happens. Oh, Scott, you asked such a wonderful question. He's like, are donations to Axol still being matched? We're having a matching grant program next month in November, but if anybody makes a donation now, I promised it will match it next month. We do have a very generous individual who's given us $10,000 for a matching grant program. And yeah, this is how we survive. This is how we take the actions that we take. We only get operating on private donations. And one of the reasons why is when we apply for grants, guess what? We don't get them. So it was pretty crazy. Okay, and then it says for all of those in the San Diego area, a reminder that we, Axol, have an in-person meeting coming up about a month from now on Saturday, November 16th. It will be at Cal Western Law School. Bless them that they actually give us a meeting room. He said, I went last year and found it informative and supportive. There was a huge turnout last year, and maybe it's because we bring cookies, I don't know, and refreshments. No, I'm taking it seriously, folks. Please come to the meeting. We only do this year, we're only doing three in-person meetings. And remember, our conference was virtual. And then hopefully we'll get it back up to four next year. But we, are all over the state as well. So this will be our only meeting in San Diego this year. And it probably will be about 12 months before we go back to San Diego. So there's details, the address, actually, I know what it is, 225 Cedar Street. Cedar, like the tree, CEDAR, 225 Cedar Street. If you just come into the lobby, they'll direct you to the right room and everything. And you know what? It is a good time to meet in person. Whatever issues might be at the forefront on November 16th, we'll be talking about those. And of course, it gives you an opportunity to network and to ask questions of me and other board members. And usually, too, on these monthly meetings, we have at least two board members. And so I have to say that I'm missing the second board member because they, yeah, don't get a break. But anyway, I'm happy to be here. Okay, so thank you for that. Here we go. Another reminder about the emotional support group meetings. Thank you, Marty. Folks, these emotional support group meetings are really important. I have seen such wonderful things happen in the emotional support group meetings, which I don't attend meetings themselves, but I've seen people who have come, I don't want to say come out of the closet. It's more like watching a flower bloom. And one of them has, in fact, joined our board of directors, our foundation board of directors. And she was so timid and so, I mean, she hardly ever said anything. And now she is a force of nature, quite frankly. And she is out there and she's talking about what it's like to be on the registry, how ridiculous it is to be on the registry and how the registry in and of itself is not effective. So one of the things I want to remind you all too, in case you don't know this, the ultimate goal of the Alliance, Axol, is in fact to get rid of the registry. Okay. We know that the registry doesn't make sense. We want it to go away. And, there's at least two different paths to do that. One path is the full frontal direct approach, which is kind of like pulling a pin on a grenade and throwing it into the courtroom. I don't agree with that approach. Okay. Because guess what? It can backfire on you. Just think about Smith versus Doe and all the trouble that case has, and all the harm that has caused that decision. So I believe in the other approach, which is an incremental approach. And what I mean by that is we're just chipping away. Halloween sign requirements, presence restrictions, residency restrictions. We just keep chipping away at that. Sometimes I think of myself as a termite, believe it or not, and just gnawing at the wooden infrastructure under the registry and waiting for the damn thing to fall. And with my board members, one time we get together once a year in person. And so the last time we did this a few months ago, I brought the game of Jenga. So if anybody's ever played the game of Jenga, where you pull out the little wooden blocks and everything until the thing crashes. I also think about that. That's what we're doing in playing Jenga. We don't know which lawsuit is going to bring the whole registry down, but there's going to be a lawsuit that does, right? Either that or the president's son is going to be put on the registry. I don't know what it's going to take, folks. But so we do take an incremental approach. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, our now deceased, she really believed in incrementalism. She persuaded me that this is the best way to approach it. And I think I've persuaded most of my board members now. I wish that there was a magic word or phrase or lawsuit, quite frankly, that all we had to do was utter that phrase or word or file that lawsuit and the problem would be solved. But it's just not true. And one of the things that Justice Ginsburg said, it was about Smith for sorry, Roe versus Wade, which has nothing to do with our community at all. But Roe versus Wade, she predicted that case would be overturned. Think about it. She predicted before she died that Roe versus Wade would be overturned. And the reason she predicted that is she said there wasn't a firm enough foundation laid for that decision. And so, in fact, the people who opposed that decision did, in fact, they used an incremental approach until, in fact, it came tumbling down. So it took them 50 years. I am not that patient. So I'm not going to wait 50 years. We're gnawing away at the infrastructure every day and with every lawsuit. And it's not just lawsuits, it's also legislation. Eventually, it will come down. Eventually, people will wake up. And I told you I'm an optimist by nature. Yep, I am, and I'm proud of it. And I just see that someday our society's going to wake up and they're going to say, oh my God, what did we do? It's kind of like with these internment camps for the Japanese, right? What did we do? How could we have made such a stupid mistake? I think it will happen. Question whether or not it happened in my lifetime, your lifetime, I don't know. But at some point in time, I think society will wake up and realize that they've made a terrible mistake. Okay, that is what I have to say today. So, if there are any final statements that folks want to make or questions, I'm open to listening. If not, I will just bid you adieu and look forward to seeing you next year and next month, not next year, next month. Okay, who can I turn to? Look, I'll keep this thing going. Oh, Lauren, you have your hands up. Please go ahead. Lauren, can you unmute yourself, please?
Yes, ma'am. There we go.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, Janice. I wanted to pass on, and I don't know if you had heard about it, as far as, do you know what the guidelines are for like military establishments, once you're on the registry, denying entry, things like that? I asked this question, of course, because I am retired, which I do carry an ID card. However, I am not allowed onto the bases. To include, of course, medical care, things like that, which I am 100% service connected. So those stipulations, and also along those same lines, and I don't know the actual number, so I don't even want to, make a number up, but hundreds of people lost jobs over at the shipyard due to that implementation.
Sure, I'm not surprised, unfortunately. Lauren, I don't have one answer to your question or your comment. Unfortunately, it seems to be higgledy-piggledy. In other words, some bases are allowing people on the registry to come on base and some are not. I have intervened in several situations, and at least two of them have been successful. So one person was, in fact, a cancer survivor or had cancer and was being treated for cancer, and all of a sudden they weren't letting him on base. It was a naval base, and before I finished, guess what? He was able to go on base for his treatments. Another person had storing an RV and a boat on a military base and wanted access to his property just to take it off the base. And first he was told no, and I was able to get him basically a pass so he could take his property off base. So, but there's other bases that are just saying, heck no, we're not going to let you. So if you had approached me individually next week, I can explore this further with you. Okay, Dan, you have your hand up. Dan, are you still with us? There you go.
I am. I'm a military retiree, and just a short statement. I was surprised in November of 2022, I think it was, when all this went in effect and I was denied access. So what I did was I was directed to the Provost Marshal's office on base and filled out some forms, and a decision was made there that grant me access. So even though I'm still on the registry, I'm able to access a military base. That's on a case-by-case basis. So you have to go to your local facility or installation and see the Provost Marshal's office and submit your application for entry.
Thank you for sharing that, Dan, and I'm glad that you were successful. I know some people who've tried that and been unsuccessful. And I don't know if it depends upon what the conviction offense was, how long ago it was, or that we, having an open-minded commanding officer. But anyway, I'm glad that you were able to gain access.
It seemed to hinge in part on their relationship with the local enforcement, law enforcement personnel.
Okay, that
Odd
makes sense to
as
me.
that sounds.
Yeah. Jim writes, I am also a vet with 90% disability, just denied access to a base. And Jim, if that's true, would you please contact me next week? I filed one lawsuit on this issue and it was unsuccessful, but it might have been I didn't have the best plaintiff. And so I'm willing to file another lawsuit. And by the way, I'm also willing to file another lawsuit about the International Megan's Law. I think it's absolutely terrible that anybody has to have a unique identifier added to their passport. And when I argued the first case, here in California, I said, what are we doing as a country? The only two countries in the history of the world that have ever added something like this to their citizens' passports were Nazi Germany and Russia. In both cases, it was the passports of Jewish citizens saying that, I'm a Jew, right? And the Nazis, of course, used it to keep people from leaving the country ultimately. But this is ridiculous. And by the way, the judge was not so bright that day. I have to be careful what I say about judges, especially on a recording. But anyway, she made this ridiculous statement about the unique identifier, and she said, "Oh, what's the big deal about this unique identifier on the passport?" She said, "You just show it one time when you enter a country." Well, it was really obvious to me that she's not traveled overseas because, and by the way, I just got back from an overseas trip. And people want to see your passport constantly, right? You enter the country, of course, but not it's not just then. Sometimes you go to a bank to exchange money, go to a museum, you check in the hotel, they want to see your passport. So obviously she didn't know what she was talking about and she ruled against us. But I'm willing to consider another IML challenge and I'm looking for my perfect plaintiff to do that. So if you think you might be, contact. I'm Marty. Marty, you're is always such a is an eager volunteer. He says, use me as a litigant in any lawsuit. Just go ahead and file. Marty, you might not be my perfect plaintiff. Sorry to say that. So who am I thinking about? I'm thinking about somebody who probably committed the offense at a relatively young age, something that was a non-contact non-violent offense, such as possession of child pornography. But if you think that you might fit that criteria, please let me know. And by the way, sometimes I say the perfect plaintiff, the Rosa Parks plaintiff. And I hope you all know that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his community, they chose very carefully Rosa Parks as a plaintiff. They had considered some other people, but Rosa Parks was chosen because she was a librarian. She'd never been charged with or convicted of any crime in her entire life. And I think she didn't even drink alcohol. So, you know, they thought she was a pretty good candidate. And they turned down some other people who had a past. I believe one of them was an unmarried woman who had a child. Remember how long ago that was. So anyway, I'm looking for the perfect or the Rosa Parks plaintiff in the IML case. If you think you're that person, please contact me, because I'm actually itching to file another lawsuit challenging that law. I just think it's so terrible, even giving a 21-day notice, right? But the unique identifier in particular. And by the way, when I filed the challenge, you know, back in 2016, I believe it was, that the government attorney basically said, yeah, and the judge too, well, it's not going to be that big a deal. You know, that this unique identifier is going to be at the back of the passport and, you know, the endorsement pages, which are like page 25 and beyond. Well, to that, I do say bullshit, because guess what? They're now, the unique identifier now is put on page one. It's on page one of your passport. So when they open up your passport, there it is. It says this person's been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. Yeah, right. So anyway, things have changed, and I think I might even have a better chance now of challenging the International Megan's Law. Okay, now I'm really going to say goodbye. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here, and I look forward to seeing you next month. Take care. Bye-bye.